ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
More than 100 years ago, Ernest Shackleton died on board a sealer. The ship was called Quest, and the legendary explorer had taken it south towards the Antarctic for one final expedition. While no one is of Antarctica, no one can really claim the continent as their home, perhaps Shackleton comes the closest. He was at the helm of a time in history known as the heroic age of Antarctic exploration and led several expeditions to that inhospitable, mysterious part of the world. One of those journeys was so remarkable, it's become known as the greatest survival story ever told. And my guest today knows that story very well. Tim Jarvis is an environmental scientist, an author, and an adventurer who reenacted Shackleton's extraordinary feat without modern comforts. Tim, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you, Sally.
Tim, I'm in the business of reading stories, and I have to say that the story of Ernest Shackleton is just one of the most extraordinary I've ever read. What does he mean to you?
Well, you know, you're right. It was described by Sir Edmund Hillary, or his survival journey, as the greatest survival journey of all time. And I'm referring to the one that he undertook when his ship, the Endurance, sank. And look, I think Shackleton, for me, is just a shining example of crisis leadership, how you can get things right and pluck victory from the jaws of defeat and bring everybody home and show all these really incredible characteristics in getting everyone home safely. He's a hero, really. I know the term gets overused, but he really is a hero.
What do you think were the personal traits that made him such an exceptional leader, Tim?
Well, you know, I think I don't really like the phrase, but I think he was emotionally intelligent. In other words, he really understood what made people tick. He could relate to people easily. He really had this unique ability to put himself in someone else's shoes. And I think that came from his background. He was Anglo-Irish. As far as the Irish were concerned, he was a bit too English and vice versa. He had a lot of women in his life in the form of sisters and a mother who perhaps made him a little bit more emotionally aware than your average Edwardian male would have been at the time. And he was merchant navy rather than Royal Navy. So he knew what it was like to feel sort of second tier rather than Royal Navy. He was merchant navy. And I think all of this taught him how to fit in and find points of common ground with people. And he used that to very good effect in leading his men.
So for those who are listening, if they're not up to date with the story of Ernest Shackleton, let's just take people through briefly this endurance expedition to Antarctica. So they left the island of South Georgia off the tip of South America in December 1914 in this ship. They weren't on the seas very long before they got trapped in pack ice in January 1915. What happened, Tim?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the goal was to obviously land on the continent and make a bid to be the first ones to cross it from one side to the other because, of course, Scott and Amundsen had achieved the South Pole, which is kind of in the middle, if you like. Scott dying along with all of his men and Amundsen doing it very successfully. And so Shackleton needed to land at a place on the coast of the Weddell Sea. And he left South Georgia and encountered pack ice very, very early on in the expedition in January, but really had no choice but to keep on trying to push south to make a landfall on Antarctica.
And so when their ship Endurance gets stuck in the ice, how many months are they stuck for, Tim?
Well, they're stuck for 10 months. And the difficulty was that probably halfway through that, I think they all intuitively knew that the ship was never going to sail home. The pack ice that closed in around the hull was so thick and, you know, the pressure so immense that the hull had been damaged by that pressure of the ice pushing in around it. And I think they all knew that it was never going to sail home. And so they were there for 10 months, but I think half of that they knew that you know, their home was gone and their means of escape from Antarctica were effectively gone.
The strangest thing, reading some of the accounts of that time, they not only talk of surviving, but often being cheerful. They were playing sport. There were musical instruments. They had dogs. They had a cat. The mood in those early months seems quite extraordinary given where they were.
You know, that's absolutely right. And the best thing is obviously to keep busy when you're in these situations because, you know, frankly, they were staring death in the face because they wouldn't have had enough food to survive through the following winter. And, you know, they've been there for 10 months on the ice eating penguins and seals and, frankly, anything they could find to supplement the food they'd taken off the ship. But in that situation, Shackleton had introduced this system of you know, language lessons and slide nights and soccer and stuff like that just to keep people busy. And I think for the men, it was a very clever move because they thought, you know, the leader had the measure of the circumstances in which they found themselves. Because otherwise, why would you be playing soccer and having slide nights if the leader felt that the game was up and everyone was going to die on the ice? So I think this really instilled a sense of confidence in Shackleton amongst the men because he just treated the circumstances as pretty normal.
So towards the end of November 1915, the pressure of the ice on the ship becomes too much and Endurance is sunk. What plan does Shackleton come up with when that happens?
Well, you know, the plan now, bear in mind they've drifted almost down to the Antarctic coast. They were only 70 k's short when the ship finally was, the hull was finally breached by the ice, and then it drifted far further north before it then sank. The plan was pull the three lifeboats, which effectively are 22-foot, 7-metre long keelless rowboats, but they weigh a lot, and try and pull these like a sled towards the coast of the Antarctic Peninsula, which is pretty much to their west. Problem is, this is still hundreds and hundreds of kilometres away. The boats are heavy, the men are tired, and the pack ice is thick, and you've got these great pressure ridges you're trying to pull these heavy boats over. There's not even anybody at your final destination. There's no one who lives on the Antarctic Peninsula. So, you know, really, you're wondering why you're doing it. And in fact, it proved to be pretty futile. They only managed a few Ks in 3 or 4 days of heavy pulling.
After some failed attempts, he then came up with a plan of getting in one of the lifeboats and trying to go to Elephant Island. Is that right?
They set up camp on the ice after realizing the futility of trying to pull the boats. And they spent a month at this camp. And then after a month, Shackleton realized the men were getting a bit restless and beginning to question his leadership. So he thought, we'll give it another try with pulling the boats. They pulled them for 10 days and made 7 miles, I think it was. So about a K a day, essentially. And there they made camp again and they sat it out until the ice broke up beneath them and they had no choice but to rewrite the three lifeboats, get in them and paddle to Elephant Island.
What was Shackleton's plan after they reached Elephant Island? What was his plan for trying to reach South Georgia?
With Elephant Island, it was Elephant Island or bust because there's nothing really beyond Elephant Island apart from South Georgia, but South Georgia is 800 nautical miles away, about 1,500 k's. So they had to get to Elephant Island in the three open rowboats, which they managed to do. But Elephant Island is a, you know, it's a very inhospitable place. It's a jagged fang of rock sticking out of the Southern Ocean, very rough, very cold, no human population even then. And they fell ashore and they celebrated because, of course, they'd spent so much time at sea. They'd been almost 20 months at sea, much of the time in a stricken ship and then living on the pack ice, hoping not to die. But Shackleton knew no one would find them on Elephant Island. Only thing for it, get in the most seaworthy of the three rowboats, take the best men and attempt this 1,500 k journey across the Southern Ocean to South Georgia where there were whaling stations and he could raise the alarm.
How extraordinary was the navigation even for them to be able to get to South Georgia without modern navigation techniques and hoping that the winds would take them in the right way?
Well, you know, it was absolutely just remarkable. I mean, look, it's the roughest ocean in the world. You're navigating using a sextant. A sextant gives you an angle to a celestial body like a star or the sun. The trouble is they never saw any stars. It was too cloudy. They saw the sun twice in 800 nautical miles. So 1,500 Ks of open ocean, they saw the sun twice. And they managed in a boat that's tossing violently on the ocean. One man held on to each leg of Frank Worsley, the navigator, and he took two sun sights. And on the basis of that, they were able to work out their latitude, the north-south on the map, and basically get to the latitude that the island was on and then turn in and head for South Georgia. I mean, it was just the most remarkable needle in a haystack navigation. Had they missed it, by the way, the same winds and currents that had sort of pushed them up in that direction would have pushed them straight past South Georgia. And the next land is Namibia, about 5,000 Ks further on.
Podcast, broadcast. This is Conversations with Sally Sara.
This little boat that they're in, it was about the length of a cricket pitch, roughly, Tim. Is that a good way to think of it?
It's shorter than that. I mean, it's basically 22 feet, so only 6.7 metres. So it's about a third of a cricket pitch. It's basically a surf boat. That's what people need to think of. In fact, the Royal Navy ship-to-shore lifeboats were just that. They were just a rowboat. In fact, surf boats were modelled on the old Royal Navy ship-to-shore rowboats. So it's basically exactly the same size as a surf boat.
Now, when Shackleton and these few men arrive on South Georgia, this is when a remarkable story becomes truly remarkable, because they've landed on one end of the island, and to get to the whaling settlement that they need to reach, they need to go cross-country over South Georgia. Paint a bit of a picture for us, Tim, of how extreme the topography of South Georgia is.
Well, South Georgia is a subantarctic island, and it's spectacular. It has a spine of mountains which are very, very technical mountains, look like Himalayan peaks. They rise from the sea straight up to the highest one is 10,000 feet, and they are a really gnarly mountain range, snow-capped, full of glaciers and crevasses, and it is technical mountaineering, and no one had ever been into the interior. And here's Shackleton. He arrives on the southwestern side of the island. He lands where he can. Three of his men are debilitated through the effects of the journey, and he and the two others are faced with the prospect of trying to cross this uncharted, technical mountaineering terrain with freezing temperatures, strong winds, in cotton smocks, woolens, and leather boots, with nails pushed through the soles for grip, no tent. And, you know, it was just an impossible task that faced them.
How many kilometres from where they landed did they need to travel to be able to reach the whaling settlement?
It was only about just over 30 Ks, but 30 Ks of technical mountaineering is 30 Ks of technical mountaineering. I mean, if you want to go up Everest, it's only 6 or 7 Ks, you know, horizontal. It's the vertical that gets you. And the same with South Georgia. You know, you've got to get up into these mountains, get down very, very steep terrain with no climbing equipment and no experience and no maps. Was desperate. The boat journey was absolutely incredible. The crossing of the mountains was equally incredible.
It's almost, Tim, like the sort of the pentathlon of adventure, given what they'd been through even at the start of their journey, their time on the ice, the sinking of endurance, trying to push the boats, then getting to Elephant Island and then this journey, and then they have to get across these mountains to reach rescue. It's just beyond the beyond.
It really is, you know. I mean, if it were a triathlon, you'd have living in a stricken ship, thinking you're going to die in brutally cold conditions and then on the pack ice, followed by the most incredible, treacherous, grueling brutal open boat journey across the Southern Ocean with two storms and a hurricane where the men were hypothermic, the boat was threatening to capsize, and then crossing these mountains with just no equipment and no maps and no know-how, no real climbing know-how.
And they decided to do it in one hit as well.
Well, they did it in one hit only because they couldn't stop. I mean, the thing with polar expeditions, of which I've done many, is that, you know, the only way really that you generate the warmth you need to survive, even in modern expeditions, is by moving. And they had no tent, so they had no choice really but to just keep moving the whole time. As if they stopped for any length of time, they would have frozen to death. So they had no choice but to do it just in one go.
And it was kind of all for one and one for all, in that they were tied together in some of the mountain parts as well to try and keep each other safe. But if one went down in a crevasse, they probably all would have gone.
Well, you know, if you have a bad enough crevasse fall, one person could pull both the others in. More likely, you know, two would fall in a crevasse. You know, the key thing with crevasses is you want to try and cross them at a right angle, so you're sort of stepping over them. If you walk along the line of them, you've got multiple opportunities to sort of fall in the same crevasse. It's a really committing thing when you're roped up to other people and you haven't got any climbing equipment to really arrest a fall. It's just hoping the other people don't fall too badly if they do fall.
With all the difficulties and misfortune, something remarkable, and I'm sure Shackleton and his men were very grateful, a full moon. The moon came out when they were undertaking this incredible journey through the night, through the darkness. Shackleton's description of that is quite magical, that they were able to see their way in this silvery light.
Oh, you know, it must have been just so otherworldly. They were already in a different place mentally. They were already conscious of perhaps something bigger than them, provenance, I think they called it. They referred to the fact that provenance was there and guiding them. And visually, it just must have been the most magical sight to see the moon lighting up the surface of the ice and seeing the crevasses as these long, thin, menacing veins of black in between, you know, that you don't want to go in, obviously. But the whole thing would have been really otherworldly.
Tim, they've gone up over these enormous mountains and then they're then faced with the challenge of how on earth they descend. I know there are technical mountaineering terms for it, but basically they slide on their backsides down hundreds or thousands of feet down the side of one of these peaks.
Yeah, look, I think, excuse the French, but it's probably the longest bum slide in history, 1,500 feet in the old money, 500 metres down, about a 60-degree slope, you know, very, very steep indeed. And the most remarkable thing is that they didn't even know what was there. They just slid because they had no real choice. You know, if you're cold and you're tired and darkness is coming on and you're up high and you need to get down fast, it's the fastest way down, particularly if you don't have any decent climbing equipment to actually climb down. But I got to the same spot 100 years on and I couldn't believe what they'd done.
What does Shackleton say in his diary about what that was like?
You know, they're fearful of it, but when they actually come to do it, I think they quite enjoyed it. I mean, certainly it worked, but, you know, they approached it with a great deal of trepidation. But he talked about fingers of fog and mist coming in from behind and just coming down through the mountains. And they'd been on this high ground and this kind of fog was threatening to envelop them with weather that probably would have killed them in terms of the temperature. And so they were escaping the icy grasp of the mountain by sliding down to get to the next stage of the journey.
When they start getting closer to the settlement, Shackleton thinks that he hears a sound. What does he hear, Tim?
He's got the marine clock from the boat, the chronometer, which is still keeping reasonably accurate time. And they needed that, of course, for their calculations when they were doing their sun sights with their sextant on board the boat. And so he knows roughly what time it is, and he thinks, if it is the time I think it is, and we are where I hope we are, then we should hear the whistle calling the men to work at the whaling station. You know, this foghorn going through the valley will be very, very clear and easy to hear. And sure enough, at the moment, the clock strikes midday or whatever it was, and they hear the sound of the whistle at the whaling station. He said it's the sweetest music he'd ever heard.
What's incredible about that is, so this is, we're talking May 1916. This is the first human sound they've heard from others since the end of 1914.
Yes, you know, they left on the eve of the First World War in August 14, and, you know, the rest of the journey really was, it was 22 months they'd been out, was either at sea in a stricken vessel expecting to die, living on the pack ice, expecting to not make it, getting to Elephant Island, which was torturous in its own right, and then this incredible open boat journey across the Southern Ocean. So much water had passed under the bridge. To get to that point, they were probably just beside themselves.
What kind of reception do they get, Tim, as they arrive into the settlement looking pretty wild after their journey?
Well, I mean, the settlement was basically mainly men involved in whaling, mainly Norwegians, and but there were some women there, and also some kids, some families, and a boy sees them and runs away screaming in terror at the sight of these guys because they're malnourished, frostbitten, wearing rags, long beards. They look pretty ghostly when they emerge from the mist. And Shackleton goes up and knocks on the door of the manager's hut. The guy comes to the door, and in fact, the guy, Serler, knew Shackleton well. He opened the door and he saw this apparition in front of him. And he said, I think I know you, but I can't place you. And he said, I am Shackleton. And apparently Serler had tears running down his cheeks, a tough old Norwegian whaler, because he was just, along with everybody else, convinced that they'd all died down in the ice.
And that's not even the end of the story, because they need to go back and collect some of his men who are on the other side of South Georgia, then go and get the men from Elephant Island. That takes three or four attempts. And then a mission also needs to be sent for the team that had put out supplies on the other side of Antarctica for them as well. It wasn't over, Tim.
No, look, it was far from over. I mean, they Shackleton and the two strongest had done the mountain crossing. They then had to get the three men they'd left behind on the other side of South Georgia. They picked them up safely enough. But then when they tried to head south back to Antarctica, to Elephant Island, to pick up the 22 men left behind, they couldn't get through the pack ice. They had to retreat back to South Georgia. They attempted it a second time in a whaling ship, couldn't do it. In the end, they were reduced to going back to South America, where they took another vessel. They managed to scrape together some money and get a vessel together. That caught fire. And it was only the fourth attempt, a boat called the Yelcho from the Chileans, that they managed to get down there and pick up the men. But over that, you know, a further 5 or 6 months had elapsed. And so, you know, the men on Elephant Island must have felt that Shackleton had evidently died at sea, and what a prospect to take the B team in the B boat and attempt the same journey that killed the A team. And of course, yeah, you're right, there was a whole separate team of people on the far side of the continent who had been putting out food depots in the direction of the pole, the intention being Shackleton would pick them up on his crossing of the continent. And of course, he never set foot on the continent, and all of that effort was wasted. And three men died in the process of that depot laying. So it was far from over.
But in terms of the men on the Endurance, he got all of his men back safely.
He saved everyone. You know, I think with respect to Shackleton, he couldn't really be expected to manage circumstances on the far side of the continent, 2,800 kilometres away, where unfortunately there were three deaths. But no, in terms of what he managed to do, he brought everybody home alive, which is just, you know, it's remarkable. It's the kind of thing that leaders should do. You know, they should always look out for their people. And many of us would like to think we have those characteristics, but Shackleton really did.
What do we know about the reunion on Elephant Island when Shackleton goes back to collect those men who've been waiting there, hopefully?
Well, you know, apparently Frank Wild, who was the number two in the expedition team, he was in charge of the men on Elephant Island, and he would say each day, you know, come on, lads, pack up your stuff. The boss may be coming today, as they used to call him. Of course, they did that 130 times because 4.5 months of doing it. I don't know if that would have motivated me or not, getting my bags ready to go and then realizing that sinking feeling that the boat hadn't appeared on the horizon. When Shackleton came, he waved and then he counted people on the beach. And as soon as he got within shouting distance, he said, "How many are you?" And they said 22. And he realized that everyone had survived. And it was just a remarkable moment. They were just not defeated, just desperately relieved that they'd been saved.
This is Conversations with Sally Sara.
Tim, it's one thing to admire and be astonished by this story of Sir Ernest Shackleton. It's another thing to start getting the idea in your mind of perhaps trying to reenact it. Where did this come from?
Yes, you know, it's true. Look, I've done many polar expeditions in using modern equipment, and I guess I'd always wondered in my mind how I would have fared had I done things back in what they called the heroic era of polar exploration. Shackleton, Mawson, Amundsen, Scott, you know, how would I have fared? And so that was always in the back of my mind. And I'd undertaken a journey to retrace the expedition of Douglas Mawson that had been successful using the old equipment. And I received a call from Sir Ernest Shackleton's granddaughter, who said, you know, "Well done on achieving what you did with your Mawson expedition. I'd be honored if you would assemble a team to retrace my grandfather's journey, celebrate what he'd managed to achieve." You know, I was very honored to be asked to do this. And I suppose for me, it was, you know, it's like getting the opportunity to go out and bowl against Bradman or something. You know, it's just one of those things. You get the chance to turn the clock back and see how you will fare. And in so doing, just undertake this most remarkable of journeys.
What kind of reaction do you get from your family, Tim, when you break this news?
Well, in terms of my parents, my mother never knew, and she said, "I didn't know you did that," you know, and I think I probably told her the details of it all afterwards. My wife was supportive. You know, she said, "Look, this is who you are. I understand you want to do it. I don't earn money out of these expeditions. I do it for the love, and I try and use the experiences I have to push positive messages about leadership and teamwork applied to some of the issues we're faced with today."
Who did you decide to take with you?
Well, that was a long and interesting process. I mean, Shackleton on the original expedition apparently posted an advert that no one's been able to find that said, "Men wanted for hazardous journey, months of bitter cold, darkness, low wages, honour and recognition in case of success, safe return doubtful." And he got 3,000 applicants for the 27 spots. I only needed 5 other people. And I got about 300 applicants. I needed two climbers and 3 sailors, and they had to gel as a team, be selfless. And it took a long time to find the right group of people. But once I found them, I knew I had the right team.
What's your radar like, Tim, on many of the expeditions that you've been on, or if you're getting ready to head somewhere? How do you kind of sum people up or get a feeling as to whether someone's going to be able to make it or not, or will be a good member of the team or not?
Well, I think everybody thinks that they're going to be good because most people can talk a good expedition. Most people's CVs in my field of, you know, outdoor stuff say, you know, "I'm a good team player, I'm good under pressure." But you need to be able to see that. And so as the leader of one of these things, you need to give people tasks, see how they perform, see what initiative they demonstrate when things invariably go wrong in training, in planning. You're trying to pull together a lot of money. You're trying to pull together complex logistics. You've got to rebuild a boat. You've got to train in gear, which is woefully inadequate for either climbing or sailing. And you soon start to see what people are made of.
Tell us about the clothing, the personal gear that you had that was as close as you could possibly get to what Shackleton's team had. What's it like?
Well, there was no Gore-Tex back then, so what they wore for these Antarctic journeys was what they called, well, it's gabardine. It was basically a Burberry clothing, sort of a like a dryer-bone cotton with a bit of waterproofing to it, but mainly it was windproof and breathable. That's what you wanted, because Antarctica is the driest, windiest, coldest continent in the world. And you don't get rained on very often, if at all. And so the clothing was not designed for a wet, open boat journey. It was cotton. And it was terrible for Shackleton, and I have to say it was pretty terrible for us.
What about the boat that you took with you down to Elephant Island to begin the journey?
The boat, the good news is, the original made it home, and even though it was almost destroyed, it went back to London and was almost destroyed by a German bomb during the Second World War, but luckily someone had the presence of mind to put it on a trailer and take it out of London during the Blitz and hidden in some countryside location, and now it's back at his school in London, and we were able to go and measure it all up, climb inside, and just make a perfect replica of the boat. And it is, you know, it is what it is, a 6.7 meter long keelless rowboat, essentially, with a deck and a hatch, and that's it.
For safety, you had another vessel following you with modern equipment and a backup team just in case?
Well, we had another boat in the Southern Ocean, but how helpful they would really have been remains to be seen. I mean, really, if you're in a boat and you capsize and your other boat is 50, 60, 80, 100 Ks away, which was often the case, you know, and you fall in the water and it's 1 degree Celsius, maybe a little bit colder, and you're not wearing a life jacket, you're just wearing a cotton smock with woolens and leather boots, believe me, and it's in a storm that you've fallen overboard, a boat 10 Ks away, 20 Ks away may as well be in a different ocean. It's of no real use to you. So yes, they were there. Practically speaking, all they would have done is pick up the pieces of the people left behind in the upturned boat, but the people who fell overboard would have been goners.
When you're on watch, when you're trying to steer this boat, how are you doing that, and how are you navigating to try and make sure that you make it to South Georgia?
Well, navigation is about seeing the sun, and the difficulty is you've got to see the sun when it's at the high point in the sky for your latitude. No point seeing it early in the morning when it's low on the horizon. It's got to be at the high point to be of any use to you to do what they call noonday sights. And we only saw it twice, which in 2 weeks, which made that very challenging. In terms of steering, the boat had no tiller, like an arm attached to the rudder. It just had ropes. And you just pulled them left and right with all your strength to try and steer the boat down the face of big waves, stop it capsizing, and to try and keep it on a northerly bearing. That's all we were trying to do, was go north to try and reach the 54 degrees south line of latitude, which is a horizontal on the map. And as soon as we got to that, the idea was to turn right and head in on that line of latitude until we reached South Georgia. And it worked. You know, it wasn't easy, but it worked.
What was it like down below in those kind of seas, especially when to keep going, you need to eat, even though it's as rough as can be?
Well, I mean, the food we had was pretty terrible. We ate lard, which was the sledging ration used to be, on those early expeditions, was made of something called pemmican, which is basically congealed lard. So it's not great eating that when you're being thrown around like you're in a washing machine. You know, physical sickness stalked everybody. You're in a cold, fetid, unpleasant, wet, cramped space below deck, about the size of a queen-size double bed for six grown men, no lying down, just sitting on top of rocks, and in our case, camera batteries to power the cameras that filmed the whole experience. And, you know, it was just pretty brutal, you know, sleep deprivation. You couldn't get the stove going very frequently because if you did, the kero fumes were just overwhelming in such a small space. So we all just suffered and were sick and tried to sleep in the seated position under the wet reindeer skins and just shuffled round. Each time someone came down off the helm, everyone would shuffle round one, and then ultimately five hours later, it'd be your turn again.
Did you ever have any second thoughts while that was all going on, Tim?
I had second thoughts about 10 minutes into day one. And I think, you know, I think the key thing with self-doubt, which is a very natural thing, is to just have an answer in your mind as to why to keep going. And, you know, luckily thus far I've always had those answers, but doesn't mean you're not asking yourself the question.
The navigation comes right and you make it to South Georgia and begin this journey across the mountains. How much were your thoughts with Ernest Shackleton as you began that part of the journey?
Well, my thoughts were very much with him because, for a start, we had to land where he did in order to begin the crossing of the mountains from the same place. And the day we got there, the weather was not conducive to landing where he did, but we had to. And we very nearly ended up on the rocks of South Georgia. And bear in mind, you know, these cliffs are rising out of the sea about 1,500 meters. You've got about 4,000 feet high mountains, go straight out of the ocean. And we have winds and currents pushing us onto the shore faster than we can think. And we literally scrape round a headland in pretty hairy conditions into the bay in which Shackleton landed, and were able to land at the same spot that he did. But my goodness, it was a pretty close run thing, I can tell you.
Tim, you start the journey on foot, and once you get up into some high ground, there's some troubles for one of the cameramen who's with you. He's in a lot of strife with nerve pain. It's unclear whether it could even be a blood clot, and he has to return to the vessel. There's quite a lot of back and forth about whether to continue. What was going through your mind when you were kind of stuck there up on the top of that rise trying to figure out what to do? And it was very dangerous by that stage.
Yeah, we were in a very dangerous situation. I mean, it was pretty dangerous throughout the whole thing, but we had 5 days of the worst weather that South Georgia can throw at you when we arrived. Catabatic winds gusting up to 85 knots, so that's 170, 180 k's an hour. And it was pretty brutal for the three of us that were going to continue now that we'd reached South Georgia with the mountain crossing. The original plan had been the three sailors in the team and the three climbers in the team. The three sailors, as soon as we got there, would put on modern gear, start eating normally, and they would essentially carry the equipment for two cameramen who'd come in on another boat and would rendezvous with us at the start point of the mountain crossing. And we'd do it as a team of eight, with me, Baz, and Ed as the mountaineers remaining on the old rations in the old gear. It all went wrong. You know, we lost three guys with bad feet, frostbite, malnourishment. In one case, hypothermia was coming on. And after the 5 days of having lost three guys and being beaten up a bit by the weather, I decided we needed to leave and head into the mountains. Otherwise, we were never going to get this thing done. And we did it as a team of three with the two cameramen. And we only got 4 hours in, and the first cameraman ended up with severe back pain. And there was talk of it being something like a clot. But, you know, to be honest, I think it was really mental as much as physical in his case.
You climbed up over these very same peaks that Ernest Shackleton and his men had climbed, and then you reached that very same spot where they began the big slide down the slope. What were you thinking of as you're about to set sail on your backside down that slope?
Well, I just marvelled at what he'd done. I mean, again, you know, you get to these moments where, you know, you're having experiences not dissimilar to the kind of ones that he wrote about in these famous journals. And we got to the top of the Trident Ridge, and sure enough, it's steep. It's very steep. It's very forbidding. And below you are the glaciers that will take you to the other side of the island, but you've got to get down there. And it is 1,500 feet, 500 meters down. And for us, there was a huge crevasse only perhaps 100 meters down. So to slide from the top, we would have ended up in that and killed ourselves. So we thought, okay, we will we'll climb down past that, and we'll get a bit further down, and then we'll try sliding ourselves, which is what we did. And I tell you, it was pretty exciting. But we did it from about halfway rather than the top.
What's it feel like after enduring all that physical discomfort to actually get a free ride for a few seconds at least?
Oh, look, it's a wonderful thing. And look, mountaineers will do it in controlled conditions if they know what the terrain is. And it is a quick way to get down without spending lots of energy if you know what's there. But, of course, not many people cross the mountains of South Georgia. And so, you know, it's a dynamic landscape. You know, the glaciers are moving, and so we weren't entirely sure what we were going to find, but it was a hell of a lot easier than climbing down.
The final few kilometres heading into the settlement. What kind of state are your feet in by that stage, Tim?
Oh, they were in a very, very bad state by the end. You know, I'd lost sensation in a couple of the toes. The boots had just gone to mush. They were wet leather. We'd had to wade across a glacial lake. You know, all the effort of trying to climb, wearing essentially hobnail boots that are sopping wet, with just one or two nails left in the base of the boot, had caused, you know, blisters and problems like that. So, you know, with frostbite and all the other things, my feet were in a pretty bad state.
I have to admit, I Googled Tim Jarvis toes before we did this interview. They're all still there, Tim?
They are all still there, yeah. I can't feel a couple of them, but they are still there. The nerves have been pretty badly damaged over the years, but I've still got them.
What was it like when you finally reached the finish?
You know, that's a very interesting question. And, the finish, I suppose, for us was walking into the ruins of the whaling station that he'd reached 100 years before us. Obviously, it was functioning for him. For us, it's just a derelict whaling station. And, you know, you become so good at breaking the total journey down into small pieces just to get through it mentally and physically that it actually just felt like the end of that shift. You know, just focusing all the time and watching out for danger and keeping motivated, keeping everyone moving, keeping yourself moving, that when we actually finally just stopped and there was nothing else to do, it just didn't really compute. You know, you're not quite sure what to do next. It was elation, but it was a very, very strange feeling.
They are interesting moments, aren't they, Tim, when you finally reach a goal? There's enormous sense of relief and achievement, but almost instantly sometimes it can feel like you're missing that delicious kind of anticipation of finally getting there. It's a triumph and a disappointment at the same time.
It's
sometimes
a bittersweet. It's very bittersweet. And I've experienced it many, many times with setting goals for myself and then achieving them. And of course, what then looms into view is, like most of us, I'm my own worst critic. So if by achieving something, does that elevate your performance or does it diminish the performance of Shackleton? The fact that I managed to, you know, replicate some of what he did. And you have to come to terms with that. And it's psychologically very interesting.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because in a way, with Shackleton's original mission, he failed to meet his objective in crossing the pole, but the way that he dealt with adversity in some ways almost was a bigger victory.
You know, Shackleton wasn't ultimately successful in any of his expeditions. He'd gone south with Scott. On Scott's expedition before Scott himself died, but on a previous expedition, and he'd been invalided home by Scott. He had turned round 97 miles from the pole on his bid to reach the South Pole. Then this expedition, the Imperial Transantarctic, of course, they never set foot on the continent. The ship sinks. It's all about the survival journey. And then, of course, his final expedition, he died the night he arrived back at South Georgia. So ultimately, Shackleton wasn't successful with any of his original goals. But in the case of the Imperial Transantarctic, the Endurance expedition, he achieved so much more with the survival journey that most of us now see it as just the most incredible, incredible success.
How do you see optimism, Tim? Is it powerful, dangerous, a bit of both? How do you reflect on it?
Well, I'm an optimist. I'm a pragmatic optimist. It doesn't stop me grumbling and seeing problems, but I just always look for positives. You take a bad experience and you look for the positives in it, learning something, teaching you something about yourself. You know, if the weather's bad, you say, well, that's what Shackleton had. So this has brought us closer to what he experienced. If a piece of equipment breaks, you think, well, we don't want it easy because, again, we want it to be closer to the original, and he had problems. So you're always looking for, you know, for the positives in any situation. And look, maybe it makes you a bit delusional as a person, but it certainly gives you the confidence to take on big things in maybe a misplaced, misplaced optimism. You're actually going to be able to pull them off.
Why do you think the draw, the pull of the Antarctic in particular has been so strong for you, Tim?
Oh, I think the Antarctic is just the most remarkable place. Humanity has not managed to subjugate it. You know, it doesn't really belong to anyone. It's never had a human population. It's just extreme in every respect, but beautiful at the same time. And it's vast and untamed. And it's just in our imagination that this place is out there. It's a place you can pit yourself against it and just see whether you're able to prevail or not, or whether you'll come up short. So it's this theatre upon which you can act out these most incredible feats of endurance, if you like. And I think it's just drawn people on right from the day that it was first discovered all the way up to the modern time.
And it's vast. It's about twice the size of Australia. Is that right, Tim?
It's 14 million square kilometres, and Australia is about 7.5. So, yeah, it's almost twice the size. And the average ice thickness is over 2Ks thick. It's 2,050 metres, in fact. So you've got 30 million cubic kilometres of ice in the Antarctic ice cap. And of all the world's water, 97% is in the ocean. Of the remaining 3%, 2 is actually in the Antarctic ice cap. So, look, it's vast, it's untamed, it's the highest, driest, windiest, coldest continent in the world, and it just captures your imagination.
How well do you know yourself, Tim, and what drives you? Why were you not an ordinary bloke in the suburbs living quietly?
You know, I'm someone who grew up, I'm from the old mother country originally, and I grew up in Asia as a kid, and my parents would just say, go and discover something, and just sent me off outside, and I spent a lot of time outdoors, quite a bit of on my own. You develop resourcefulness, you develop a love of nature, you feel comfortable in your own skin, and you become that person. Aristotle said, you are what you repeatedly do. And I think, you know, I did a lot of that. And I guess going ultimately to places like the Antarctic and undertaking these extreme expeditions is just a natural extension of the kind of childhood I had, albeit in the tropics, I might add. But I never saw snow really until I was in my teens. But it's the same mentality and the same love of the outdoors.
As the planet changes, how much change have we seen in the landscape in Antarctica and places like Elephant Island and South Georgia in the past 100 years?
Well, you know, Antarctica itself is actually two ice caps. There's the west and the east. The east is in a state of uneasy equilibrium where we're getting more melting but also more evaporation from the ocean and snow in the interior. So it's sort of due to warming. And that's sort of in equilibrium just about. But the western part is melting very, very quickly. And there's 7 meters of global sea level rise potentially just in the ice of the Western Antarctic ice cap. And we've had 3.2 degrees Celsius of warming there in the last 70 years. So it's really, really melting fast. In terms of South Georgia, the glaciers, 90% of them are in retreat due to the warmer conditions. And the crossing Shackleton did, he wouldn't recognize the landscape that he crossed compared to what we did 100 years later.
You went to South Georgia and his grave is there. What was it like standing there at his resting place?
You know, it is a very atmospheric place. It's a little whaler's cemetery on a remote sub-Antarctic island. All the other people there are whalers, mainly Norwegians. And all the graves are oriented east-west, with the exception of Shackleton's, who is facing south towards his spiritual home. And of course, he died there on his fourth expedition, the one after this famous one, where he went back down and he died of a heart attack the night he arrived at South Georgia and was buried there.
When you were standing there beside his grave, did you say anything, Tim?
As I walked away, I said, well, maybe this is time for us to part company. You know, it's been great traveling with you on this journey of life, and now maybe our paths will diverge. And I think he would have appreciated that. It was someone who was always looking to the next thing, and he probably would have felt that I'd I paid homage sufficiently to his story, having devoted pretty much 15 years of my life to either telling the story, retracing the journey, planning to retrace the journey. It felt like a closing of a chapter.
Tim Jarvis, thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thank you, Sally. It's been great.
This conversation was produced by Meggie Morris. Big thanks to the Conversations team. Producers are Alice Moldovan, Nicola Harrison, and Audio Studios producer Katie O'Neill. Our executive producer is Carmel Rooney. Conversations is made on the lands of the Gadigal, Turrbal, and Jagera peoples. I'm Sally Sara. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.